This is the 2014 Pacific Northwest School of the Prophets. Brother Jim Cowie is our study leader on the theme, The Kingdom of God versus the Kingdom of Men. Yahweh will destroy Nimrod. This is session 16, entitled, Who is that? Who is this that comes from Edom?
Well, thank you again, Brother David. Well, brethren, these are, it's a bit of a marathon, isn't it? These fairly continuous sessions, but anyway, it's good because it keeps you focused, if nothing else. It keeps me focused, that's for sure. Now, I did warn you a little earlier today that we're going to finish the day with a subject concerning the way that Edom is used in relation to Bible prophecy of the latter days. And that's what this study is about. So you're going to see a few quotations from some writings, particularly Brother Thomas, of course, in the course of this particular study. But we're much more importantly going to have a look at what the Scripture has to say. And we're going to let the Scripture interpret itself, as we should do. Let it interpret itself, and it will. Now, the first quotation I want to put up before you is this one from Eureka, Volume 5, page 48, where Brother Thomas writes, under a heading like Babylon and Esau Identified, they are the plagues which caused Babylon, the great city, to fall. She falls because of her wickedness in church and state, and of her sanguinary and merciless oppression of the saints and witnesses of Jesus, and of all the Jews and others she has slain upon the earth. Jeremiah, contemplating the terribleness of these latter days, says, Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. For it shall come to pass in that day, saith Yahweh Sabaoth, that I will break his yoke, that is, the yoke of Esau's house, from off thy neck, and will burst thy bonds, and strangers shall no more serve themselves of Jacob. Now, we've spent the last couple of days talking about how God is going to use Israel returning under Elijah to bring judgments upon Babylon the Great. Correct? Well, Brother Thomas says that that is breaking Esau's yoke. The judgment of Babylon is the breaking of Esau's yoke from off Israel. Okay, so he identifies the fact, he does this on several occasions in Eureka, he identifies the fact that in Bible prophecy, latter-day Edom, latter-day Esau, is the vehicle that God uses, amongst other things, to represent the system of Babylon the Great and, of course, its associates. So that's the first quotation I want to make, because it brings together some of the things that we've been considering in the last day or so. So who is Edom in the latter days? Well, some will begin with a very flimsy premise. Here's one writing of a latter-day Christadelphian writer who says, First, it is taken as a conclusion requiring no proof that the prophecies of the last days concerning Edom are about the Arabs. Since so many of the Arab tribes are descended from Esau, and because ancient Edom is unquestionably Arab territory today. Well, the latter might be partly true, but this is rubbish. No Arabs descend from Esau. There are no Edomites, literal Edomites, who can trace their bloodline back to Esau alive in the world today. They're all gone. And if that's not true, then God's a liar. Because he said in Obadiah, when I bring judgments upon Esau, I'm going to wipe them out to the man. And the Romans did that post AD 70. They wiped them out to a man. There are no descendants, literal descendants, of Esau in the world today. But the world is full of Edomites. spiritual Edomites. Because Esau was the first Jew hater. He hated Jacob. He was the first anti-Semite. And so Esau becomes the representation of all subsequent anti-Semites who hate the Jew and seek their destruction. Esau wanted to kill Jacob, didn't he? That's why he becomes the type of anti-Semites. So don't get, I know you know you're not sucked in, but never get sucked in by people. This chap, this brother, by the way, he's dead now, was celebrated in our community as a Bible student. And yet he makes a nonsensical statement like that, that is so palpably and evidently wrong. You've got to be careful. You've got to get your premise right. You want to interpret prophecy? Get your premises right. That's the lesson we learn from that. Oops. I don't even know what's happening here. Yeah, let's go back here. So, remember this quote, we say. Babylon and the goat nations. Esau will have had dominion over Jacob long enough, and the time will now have arrived to prove to mankind that there is a God that judgeth in the earth. Esau has lived by his sword, but not righteously. Now notice what he says then in yellow here. He's talking about Esau, mentions his name twice. It's in the context of Babylon and the goat nations. Okay? He says, he, Esau, crucified the king of Israel, persecuted and killed his brethren, corrupted the faith, trod underfoot the holy city 42 months, and poured out the blood of Jacob like water upon the ground in things like the Inquisition. But they who war against Zion and her sons shall be as nothing, as a thing of naught. So it's quite plain what Brother Thomas thought about Esau. He's talking about the Roman Empire. He's talking about what came out of the Roman Empire, the Babylonian system, the Catholic system. That's what he's talking about. So how do we prove all of that? Well, I'm not going to give you all the proofs, but I'm going to give you some. Esau and the nations. Is he a good representation of the nations? Yes, perfect. 70 is the number of the nations, and we considered that briefly in our studies. We didn't go to Genesis 10, but you know it's true that there are 70 names. The division of the nations after the collapse of the project to build the Tower of Babel, there were 70 nations. The generations of Esau are listed in Genesis 36. And if you're very careful, you've got to be very careful, it lists 70 different names of the offspring of Esau if you exclude the names of cities, nations and women and count the male offspring only once, because some of them mentioned twice. Do the exercise, you get 70. So Esau has 70 descendants listed off in Genesis 36. Edom became the name by which God denominated all anti-Semitic nations. And that's going to become clear when we come to Obadiah. Obadiah verse 15. The all nations involved in the controversy of Zion are called Edom in Isaiah 34 verses 1 to 6. And that's going to be one of our primary references here this evening. So maybe we might just go straight to Isaiah 34. Now Isaiah 34 is part of a context. Well, most of the scripture is part of a context, of course, isn't it? This context starts back in Isaiah 30 with the words of Isaiah 30 that Yahweh comes burning in his anger. You might want to step back. Just step back a little bit. Isaiah 30 verse 27. Behold, the name, the Shem of Yahweh cometh from far, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation. His tongue is a devouring fire. This is the reference to Christ and the saints arriving at the Mount of Olives to begin Armageddon, the process of overthrowing the nations. The subject of Armageddon goes through to chapter 33. I want to just give you a couple of hints here. Look at the last words of chapter 31 of Isaiah. Verse 9. I won't read the whole verse. Just the last words of that verse. Saith Yahweh, whose fire is in Zion and his furnace in Jerusalem. So there is where this judgment begins, in the events of Armageddon. Now, who's the subject of the judgments? Just step back to chapter 30 in verse 31. For through the voice of Yahweh shall the Assyrian be beaten down. So who's this? The latter-day Assyrian, Gog, based on what happened in the days of Hezekiah. Have a look at chapter 33, verse 1. Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled. When you read that language about spoiling, what do you think of? Gog, Ezekiel 38. Hast thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou come to take a prey? But there's a shift. In chapter 33, we read this in verse 17. Thine eyes shall see the king in his beauty, so Christ is now installed. They shall behold a land that is very far off. That's not talking about a land far off from Israel. It should be rendered. They shall see a land that stretcheth afar. So this is the land. He's going to extend his control. He shall see a land that stretcheth afar. Thine heart shall meditate terror. Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver? Where is he that counted the towers? All. Now, that's interesting. That word's used in Genesis 11. The Tower of Babel. Where is he that counted the towers? Do you know that the language here from the rest of this, for the rest of this chapter is drawn from Genesis chapter 11? Words like speech. See in verse 19. Thou shalt not see a fierce people, a people of a deeper speech. That word speech is safar. It's first occurrence is Genesis 11 verse 1. They were all of one lip, one tongue. And you can go on like that. I'm not going to go through them all. Verse 20, for example. Towards the end of the verse, not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed. Just so happens that the words shall be removed in the Hebrew are nasar, which is first used in Genesis 11 verse 2, when it says they journeyed eastward. Right? And then if you had any doubts, of course, it makes a mention of a king again in verse 22. For Yahweh is our judge, Yahweh is our lawgiver, Yahweh is our king, he will save us. It's talking about the overthrow of Babylon the Great. Now it's very important to understand that, because this is not widely understood in our community. Isaiah 34 is not about Armageddon. It's about the overthrow of the Catholic system, Babylon the Great. That's not widely understood in our community. I want to prove it to you. Brother C.C. Walker, writing in the Ministry of the Prophets, page 498, wrote concerning Isaiah 34. The opening of this chapter is an emphatic challenge of wide-reaching application, but at once tells us that we must not limit the matter to the times of Isaiah or a century or two later, nor to a few hundred square miles of territory that properly belonged to Edom in his day, because we're going to read about Edom in Isaiah 34. So let's begin to read that chapter, shall we? Verse 1. Come near, ye nations, to hear, and hearken, ye peoples, plural term. Let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world and all the things that come forth of it, for the indignation of Yahweh is upon all nations, and his fury is upon all their armies. Notice the language. Past tense. He hath utterly destroyed them. Armageddon's in the past. He hath delivered them to the slaughter. Their slain also shall be cast out, and their stink shall come up out of their carcasses. The mountains shall be melted with their blood. And then read this in verse 4. What do you reckon this is about? And all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down. Well, you see, when you roll the host of heaven together and dissolve them, you're bringing an end to all governments. It's an abolition of all human governments. This is not Armageddon. This is about 40 years later. This is when Christ has completed, or is in the process of completing his work. He's already destroyed the armies at Armageddon, and he's had a lot of other battles since. And they're about destroying Edom. Read on, verse 5. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Idumea. Now, I don't know why the translators use the term Idumea. You see, what happened in history was that that Nebuchadnezzar eventually came down and punished the Edomites for the, God says in Obadiah, but the way they treated Israel when they were taken away into captivity. And then 40 years after Nebuchadnezzar, along comes Nabonidus, and he carries all remaining Edomites from the land of Edom, and he puts them in southern Judah, which of course is a vacant land now. There's no Jews there. It's a vacant land. So he puts the residue of the Edomites in southern Judah, around where you find Bethlehem. Well, there's a lot more to that too. We won't go into that. So they, to differentiate, they called that place where the Edomites lived in the south of Judah, Idumea. They called them Idumeans to differentiate. Well, for some reason, the translators have used Idumea. It should read Edom. It's the word in the Hebrew is Edom. My sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Edom and upon the people of my curse to judgment. Now, this word curse here, kerem, means doomed, devoted to destruction. And the word is next to hormah in the dictionary of biblical Hebrew words. And hormah means utter destruction. Now, here's another point that makes that article, that selection from the brother who got it wrong, another point. The fact of the matter is that every prophecy about Edom is about them being extinct. They are doomed to utter destruction. But that's not the destiny of the Arabs, is it? The destiny of the Arabs is to be the next door neighbours of Israel in the kingdom age. So Edom can't be the Arabs. It's as simple as that. The word here, kerem, is used of Jericho as a devoted city. It occurs in Zechariah 14 verse 11. No more utter destruction. It's the last word of the Old Testament in the Hebrew, at least our Hebrew Bible, used in the context of the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15, where it's rendered which things should have been utterly destroyed. It's all one Hebrew word. Its root, karam, occurs seven times in 1 Samuel 15 as utterly destroyed. So there's no doubt about what God has in mind for Edom. Utter destruction. So when you read about Edom in Isaiah 34 verse 5, you read about him again in verse 6. Verse 6 says, and the sword of Yahweh is filled with blood. It is made fat with fatness and with the blood of lambs and goats and the fat of kidneys of rams. For Yahweh hath a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Now, it has been thought that this is about Christ and the saints coming up from Sinai to make their way to the Mount of Olives, and that along the way they encounter a portion of the Gogian host and have to deal with them at Bozrah. Wrong. It's not about a battle at Bozrah. This is a typical name that is used here. Edom and Bozrah are used typically here. Now, Edom means red. It's identified with Adam, of course, Adam, red or rosy. Edom, therefore, represents the flesh in political and religious manifestation. Bozrah can signify fortification, sheepfold, or vintage. And these two names taken together in the appellative sense denote the blood of the sheepfold or vintage. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because you can see where this is going. The land of Israel is to be a sheepfold for the slaughter of Gog initially, and thereafter Europe will become a winepress for the destruction of anti-typical Edom. So how do we know this is true, brethren? Am I pulling the wool over your eyes? I'm not. Because I want you to read verses 9 and 10 with me. Verse 9 of Isaiah 34 says this. And the streams thereof. Now, what's the thereof? What's the thereof referring to? Well, it's referring to the land of Edom. And to prove that, I'm going to read the last two lines of verse 6, and I'm going to read verse 7. For Yahweh hath a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. And the unicorn shall come down with them and the bullocks with the bulls, and their land, the land of Edom, shall be soaked with blood. So when you come down to verse 9, the thereof is the land of Edom. Okay? So the streams of the land of Edom shall be turned into pitch, and the dust thereof into brimstone, and the land, meaning the land of Edom, thereof shall become burning pitch. This is not about the literal land of Edom. It's about the spiritual land of Edom. It, the land of Edom, verse 10, shall, it rather, the fire in that land shall not be quenched night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go up forever from generation to generation. It shall lie waste. The land of Edom shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. Now, that passage just happens to be quoted in Revelation 14. And your margin will tell you that. Just happens to be quoted in Revelation 14. Just after the words, Babylon is fallen. Is fallen. It says, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels, in the presence of the Lamb. Pitch, dust, brimstone. And the smoke of their torment ascended up forever. Comes from Isaiah 34. The smoke thereof shall go up forever. And they have no rest, day nor night, who worship the beast in his image. Right. End of story. The Bible is telling us that the Edom of Isaiah 34 is the latter day Babylon the Great. Now, if that was the only proof, you might say, well, it's pretty convincing, but give me another one, please. Read the next verse. Isaiah 34, verse 11. But the cormorant and the bittern shall possess it, the land of Edom. The owl also and the raven shall dwell in it. And he shall stretch out upon it the line of confusion. Now, if you have the same margin in your Bible that I've got in mine, it says, go and have a look at Revelation chapter 18, verse 2. So shall we do that? Keep something in Isaiah 34 briefly. And have a look at Revelation chapter 18, verse 2. Now, this chapter begins with the work of the mighty rainbowed angel in verse 1, in the judgments on Babylon the Great. And in verse 2 we read, and he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become the habitation of demons, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Now, you know, I've read some interpretations of that verse that say, well, yes, the Vatican and the Catholic system is full of unclean birds, and that's not what that means. Because it's clearly a quotation from Isaiah 34. And when you come back to Isaiah 34, it tells you what it means. So you can let the Bible interpret itself. So let's come back to Isaiah 34. The cormorant and the bittern shall possess it, says in verse 11. Now, who are these cormorants and bitterns and owls? Well, they're unclean birds. Who do they represent? The nations. The unclean nations. And as you read on, you come down to places like verse 14. The wild beasts of the desert shall also meet with the wild beasts of the island. The satyr shall cry to his fellow. The screech owl also shall rest there. Where? Well, in the vacated land of Edom. Read on, verse 15. There shall the great owl make her nest and lay and hatch and gather under her shadow. There shall the vultures, they're pretty unclean, aren't they, shall be gathered. Then look at the language. I find this fascinating. What does this remind you of? Every one with her mate. Noah's Ark? The animals going in two by two? Everyone? With a mate? Yeah. So why would that be there, do you think? Well, let's just read on, verse 16. Seek ye out the book of Yahweh and read. No one of these shall fail. None shall want her mate. For my mouth it hath commanded, and his spirit it has gathered them. So who's the them here? Well, all of these unclean birds and animals. They're the them. And he hath cast a lot for them, and his hand hath divided it unto them by line. They, these unclean birds and animals, they shall possess the land of Edom forever. From generation to generation shall they dwell therein. You know why the language of the ark is used there, brethren? Because this is all about reversing the work of Nimrod. And it was 100 years after they came out of the ark that Nimrod's rebellion saw the scattering of the nations. And God's going to reverse it all. So he's working backwards, you see. Once he's destroyed Babylon, the work of Nimrod, he can then give people back their rightful inheritances, so to speak. He's going to give the territory of Europe, vacated by the Catholics, to the nations who submit to him. The unclean nations who submit to him. That's what he's going to do. So the language goes back from the rebellion of Nimrod to the ark, because that's where the problem came from. Came out of the ark. Right? As they came forth, everyone with a mate. And then they were broken asunder, so to speak. Well, it's going to be reversed. That's why you got the language of the ark, of the flood, in Zephaniah as well. So these terms, Bozrah and Edom, are typical terms. It's not about a literal Bozrah. I've actually been to a literal Bozrah. Not much there, by the way, because the prophecy of Jeremiah has been fulfilled. Bozrah, Babylon and Rome are joined together. They're etymologically linked. Bozrah means sheepfold or fortress. Babylon was in the plain of Dura, which means a wall or a rampart or a dwelling. Rome in Hebrew, Romith, which has a numerical value of 666, means a fortification. So even in the language, these places are linked. Now, by the way, I probably should have just taken you one step further before I go further with this particular slide. I should just take you to the beginning of Isaiah 35, because this series of chapters that begins with chapter 30 doesn't end until the end of chapter 35. And then you have the historical section of Isaiah. I should have taken you to verse 1 of Isaiah 35. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them. Anybody prepared to say who the them are? Well, the wild birds, the unclean birds and the wild beasts of the previous chapter, aren't they? So when it says in Isaiah 35 that the redeemed of Yahweh shall come to Zion, it's not talking about you. It's not talking about you. It's talking about the nations who are finally subject to Christ, who are given the territory of Europe, which has now been vacated by all Catholics. All right? The redeemed of Yahweh shall come to Zion, and they will come up from year to year. That's why then it says in Isaiah 35, if you have a look at verse 9, it says this, no lion shall be there. What was the symbol for Babylon in Daniel chapter 7? A lion. No lion shall be there. Got a picture? So, you know, we're just skimming the surface here, but I think you can see the proof is, it's foolproof, isn't it? It's unmistakable that God is telling us that Edom is the term, that one of the many terms that he gives to Babylon the Great of the future, based upon what happened in the past. Now, Bozrah was the capital of Edom, just as Babylon the Great or Rome is the capital of all nations who oppose Christ. Thus, Edom symbolises all anti-Semitic nations led by Catholicism in the last days. All right, so there's your summary. Let's just add to that. What do the Jews understand by Edom? Edom in Jewish tradition. The Jews understood the prophecies concerning Edom as having a double application, as having and relating ultimately to the Gentiles. Brother C.C. Walker in the Ministry of the Prophets, page 508, quotes Jewish writers to show how they saw in the oppression they suffered from Rome, they called it the rule of Esau. They referred to the Roman captivity as the Yaloth Edom, and saw in the miseries they suffered from AD 70 onwards an anti-typical application of the oppressions their forefathers had suffered from ancient Edom. So even the Jews looked upon Edom as a type of Rome. Now, we've dealt with this. This is probably where I should have been when we were dealing with the end of Isaiah 34. Sorry about that. So these unclean birds and beasts of Isaiah 34 are a symbol of the nations. They represent the Gentiles. They're released from Babylonian control when Rome is finally destroyed. They possess the land of Ijamir or Edom for the Ad Olam, for the duration of the millennium. They are the them of Isaiah 35 verse 1, for whom the once desolate wilderness of the land of Ijamir or Edom will flourish in the kingdom. So then, the great conflict of the apocalypse, Zion versus Rome, will finally come to its end. And Esau and Edom will be destroyed. Jacob Israel, redeemed. Brother Thomas says this when he's talking about Isaiah 41, verses 11 to 16. This has never come to pass since it was recorded by the prophet. For hitherto Jacob has been under the heel of Esau, whose metallic image... Interesting, isn't it? Whose metallic image stands unbroken upon its feet of iron and miry clay. The work of the second and third angels is to grind to powder the various metals of which it is composed, and to do the work so effectually that no place be found for the things they represent. Edom, abolished. And of course, we've been considering, haven't we, what this image of Nebuchadnezzar is all about. It's about the latter days. It shall be in the latter days, broken to pieces together. Brother Thomas saw correctly the breaking of that image as the destruction of Edom. And we know what the image represents. No problem with that. Esau was the forerunner of all anti-Semitic nations who seek to destroy Israel. Gog, or Russia, unites the territories of the four world empires to form the image power. The head, the thinking power, is Babylon, Catholicism of the latter days. And the Catholic-Russian alliance cements the image together. Well, you might say, well, hang on, we've done all that. Why are you going there? Doing it for a reason. I want you to come to Psalm 83. Psalm 83. Now, there's some nonsense being written on Psalm 83 right now in our brotherhood. We need to get this one right. Psalm 83 contains the title Ael Elyon. Read verse 1. Keep not thou silence, O God, that's Elohim. Hold not thy peace and be not still, O God, that's Ael. The last use of Ael, of God there is Ael. Read the last verse, verse 18. That men may know that thou, whose name alone is Yahweh, art the Most High over all the earth. The phrase the Most High is Elyon. So you have Ael in verse 1 and Elyon in verse 18. Now, there's probably very few titles more important in the Old Testament than that one, in my view, and probably not more important one in the New Testament. You know why? Because when the angel, Gabriel, came to Mary, he said, that holy thing that shall be born of thee shall be called the Son of the Highest. That's the Greek word hupsistos, which is the Greek equivalent of alion. He will be the Son of the Most High. Very, very important title. And one of the earliest titles that God gives himself in the scriptures, first occurring in Genesis chapter 14. There's something else that David can add to his list of things that he needs to get from me before I go, and that is the Bible marking notes on Genesis 14, because it's going to fill out what I'm going to say here on Psalm 83. Now, the thing about that is this. As we said, El Elyon first occurs in Genesis 14, where it occurs for four times, and the context of Genesis chapter 14 is Armageddon. It's the first place in our Bibles where Armageddon is spelled out prophetically. Genesis 14. The context is a confederacy of nations to determine to destroy Israel, verses 2 to 5. In verses 9 to 12 of Psalm 83, we have Gideon's victory over the Midianites referred to, and the destruction of Jabin and Sisera referred to. So let's just read those verses, verses 2 to 5. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, says the psalmist, and they that hate thee have lifted up, it should read this way, their head. Guess what the word head is in Hebrew? Rosh. They have lifted up their rosh. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people and consulted against thy hidden ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation. Now, that idiot, Ahmadinejad, that used to be the president of Iran, remember him? He said of Israel, let us wipe them off the map. That was the words he used. That the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent, they are confederate against thee. So that's verses 2 to 5. Now look at verses 9 to 12. Do unto them as unto the Midianites, as to Sisera, as to Jabin at the brook of Kishon, which perished at Endor, they became as dung for the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb, yea, all their princes as Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take to ourselves, and it should read, the pastures of God. Now, can you recall what we talked about when we referred to the type of Gideon and we looked at Isaiah 9 verse 4 and Isaiah 10 verse 26, that the overthrow of the Midianites was a type of Armageddon? That's what this psalm's about. This psalm is an Armageddon psalm. Now, that's just one proof. The more important proof is in the use of that title, Elyon. Because you see, when you come back, and I want you to come back to Genesis 14, I'm just going to give you a couple of points out of Genesis 14. Put something in Psalm 83, because we'll be back there shortly. Come back to Genesis 14. Verse 1. Came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar. Some ears pricking up now. Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations. Now, Tidal, king of nations, got nothing to do with the sea going backwards and forwards. Right? There are four kings there. How many parts to the image of Nebuchadnezzar? Four. Who's the head of the image of Nebuchadnezzar? Babylon. But who comes into the land of Israel leading the confederacy? Not Babylon. It's Gog. And Gog is represented here by Chedorlaomer. He's third in the list. Now, why third, do you think? Well, what's the third part of the image, the third metal? Brass. Gog comes from Constantinople. Brass and iron. You know, we talk about accuracy and pristine beauty of the scriptures. There's a case, just one case. You have a northern confederacy, comes down upon a southern confederacy, defeats them, takes Abraham's natural seed into captivity, Lot and his family. Abraham puts together an army of Jew and Gentile, pursues them, destroys them, and comes back and meets Melchizedek, brings out bread and wine, and the kingdom's established because Salem is the name of the town, not Jerusalem, not the vision of peace. Peace. And that's Jerusalem's name in the kingdom age. Psalm 76 verse 2 tells us that. Unbelievable type. Genesis chapter 14 is all about Armageddon. So I'm not going to go into all the details of it. But you see, that's why the king of Shinar, the king of Babylon, is at the head of this list. Because Babylon is the thinking power. It's the head power of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Now, when you've got that straight, then you can make sense of Psalm 83. Let me just tell you something. Here's an exercise you can do. You really want to do a really good exercise. Have a look at where this title, Aeolion, is used in the Old Testament. 40-something times. And I will guarantee you, because I've done this exercise, that on every occasion, the ideas and the context are drawn from the subject matter of Genesis 14. Usually Armageddon. But if it's not Armageddon, it's the righteousness of the Melchizedek priesthood or something along those lines. It's drawn from Genesis 4. Every time the title is used. So when you find it used, for example, in the Psalms, you know the subject is Armageddon. And that's certainly the case with Psalm 83. So let's come back to Psalm 83. Now we got up to verse 5, the end of verse 5. What we didn't read was verses 6 to 9. Sorry, 6 to 8. What we have in verses 6 to 8 are 10 nations listed. Now why 10 do you think? Well, 10 is the number for all. So these 10 nations represent the all nations who will come against Jerusalem to battle. Of Zechariah chapter 14 verse... We know the subject of this psalm's Armageddon. That's not in question. You've got at least two proofs. We know it's Armageddon, so the all nations here is a reference, or at least the 10 nations is a reference to the all nations of Zechariah 14 verse 1. Will come against Jerusalem to battle. So who are they? Look at verse 6. The tabernacles of Edom. I wonder why. Well, Edom is the prophetic name that God uses for Babylon the Great at the end of the days. The leader of anti-Semites who want to cut Israel off from being a nation. That's why Edom's there. Edom here represents Babylon the Great. Okay? The head of the image. That's why it's first. But who comes second? The Ishmaelites. Yeah. When Gog puts together its confederacy, it's going to have a lot of Arabs in it. Quite a few Arabs in it. Yeah, there'll be Ishmaelites involved. Not all Arabs, but some Ishmaelites will be involved. The Muslim element. The Ezekiel 38 verse 5 element of it. Because you see, Gog's about to take control of the area from Syria to Pakistan. And most of them are Muslim. Moab and the Hagarines. Verse 7, Gebel and Ammon and Amalek. The Philistines, the Palestinians, were the inhabitants of Tyre. And then in verse 8, Asher, that's Assyria. Why is that down there? Oh, well, that's where the legs are. Right? Which begin as brass and end up as iron. is also joined with them. They have holpen the children of Lot. So who's the thinking power behind this invasion? Assyria? The head. It's the alliance between Russia and the papacy in the West. The thinking behind this comes from Babylon. Right? I don't know if you can get it more precise than that. Can you? But as I said, we've got some nonsense being spoken about Psalm 83, so hopefully you'll do some work on that so you've got an answer. You can hold forth the word of life to those who might not have this correct. That's enough on Psalm 83. I want you to come now to Isaiah 63. How are you going with this? You handling this? You waiting for the video or something? Now here's another context that's not always understood. In Isaiah 62, verses 10 to 12, there's a call for Israel to prepare to receive its Messiah. All right? So we know this is about the return of Christ, etc. That's then followed by Isaiah 63, verses 7 to 19, where Yahweh's mercy returns to Israel who plead for forgiveness. It's all post-Armageddon. Okay? Isaiah 63, verses 7 to 19. Isaiah 63, verses 1 to 6 is clearly, therefore, a reference to the events of Armageddon and beyond. So, you know, just look at the bookends. And you can see that verses 1 to 6 is a reference to the events of Armageddon and beyond, particularly beyond. The Jews have returned in ignorance to the Messiahship of Jesus, says Brother Thomas in Helpers Israel. Hence it is they who inquire, who is this that cometh from Edom? So what Edom? Well, it's a fact, it's a literal fact, that Christ and the saints come into the land from Sinai via Mount Paran, the Arabah and Seir, or Edom. Yeah, that's a fact. So they come up this way, they come around through Mount Paran, and they pass through the land of Edom in order to cross the Jordan and to arrive at the Mount of Olives. That's a fact. But that's not what this prophecy is about. Edom and Bozrah in Isaiah 63 verse 1 are typical names. So while it's true that the journey of Christ and the saints from Sinai to the sanctuary does pass through Edom, that's not what this prophecy is about. Now the deliverance of Jacob has two stages to it. Christ will save the tents of Judah, the Jews in the land, first, immediately after Armageddon, the one-third of them who survive. Elijah will lead the second exodus for 40 years to recover all Jews who are outside the land. Ezekiel chapter 20. So here is the story. Elijah begins his work by going out to warn the Jews that they're about to get the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. That's Armageddon. When that happens, of course, then the real exodus can begin. They'll leave and they'll come into Europe eventually. And that 40-year second exodus of Israel will be undertaken. Meanwhile, of course, the events of Armageddon have allowed Christ to save the remnant of the Jews in the land, to convert them. So there are two stages. Stage one, stage two. Stage one is in the land immediately after Armageddon. Stage two requires a 40-year second exodus to accomplish. And we've had a look at this chart many times, so we know what it's all about. The work of the second exodus is to bring Israel back through the wilderness of the people and bring judgments upon the system of Babylon. And that's what this context is about. So let's find out why. Let's read verse 1 of Isaiah 63. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel, travelling in the greatness of his strength. The answer is given. I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. To save who? Well, your context tells you. Israel. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel? and thy garments like him that treadeth in the wine vat. Now, I want you to notice as I read this, because I'm going to read it as it should be read, I'm going to change the tense. I have, that's correct tense, this is past tense, I have trodden the winepress alone. And of the peoples, plural, he's not talking about being alone, because Christ will not be alone when he does this work. He'll have his saints with him. He's talking about having none of the nations with him, see? And of the peoples, plural, there was none with me, for I trod, I put that into the past tense because that's what the Hebrew is, I trod them in mine anger and trampled them in my fury, and their blood is sprinkled upon my garments, past tense. And I have stained all my raiment, for the day of vengeance was in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. And the redeemed here is Israel. Now, Isaiah 63 is actually the roots of Revelation 19. So I said the word people is plural, refers to the nations. Blood on the garments is a symbol for the conquest in war. In the context of Revelation 19 verse 13, that's exactly what you see. These and many other passages show Christ will not be alone in his conquest of the nations. He'll have people with him. This is the basis of Revelation chapter 19. So I want you to come to Revelation 19 if you wouldn't. But leave something, because we're going to come back in a minute and have a look at a verse we've looked at before. Just leave something in Isaiah 63, if you would. Come to Revelation 19. I'm going to read from verse 11 again. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness, that's the white, he doth judge and make war. That's the horse of Israel. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had a name written that no man knew but he himself. And here's your language from Isaiah 63. And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And verse 8 tells you who they are. Verse 8 tells us that the fine linen, clean and white, is the righteousness of the saints. And out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, verse 15, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treadeth, notice the words, he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he hath on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That's drawn from Isaiah 63. This is what Isaiah 63 is about. It's about the cleaning up of Babylon the Great. Got a picture? Well, I'm going to put up on the screen what you can see with your own eyes in Isaiah 63, 11 to 13. Then he remembered the days of old, Moses and his people, saying, where is he that brought them up out of the sea with the shepherd of his flock, that led them by the right hand of Moses with his glorious arm, dividing the water before them to make himself an everlasting name, that led them through the deep as an horse in the wilderness, that they should not stumble. There's the basis of a horse or horses that make their appearance in Revelation chapter 19. Now, I had quite a bit of other stuff here. And we've already gone 54 minutes. So I might truncate this a little with your permission and go to slide 31. Don't look. Come on, you're looking. I really should go here. Isaiah 21. Now I'm going to go back a step. This is a summary. Antitypical Edom relates to the political and ecclesiastical institution of Gentile nations who oppose Christ at Armageddon and beyond. It is analogous to the Gogian Confederacy of Ezekiel 38, political, Babylon the Great, Revelation 17, ecclesiastical, or the fourth beast of Daniel 7. The end of the fourth beast is the same end decreed for Edom. Total destruction. Edom does not apply to Arab nations neighbouring Israel, for they find a privileged place in the kingdom alongside of Israel. But the destiny of Edom is total destruction. So Edom cannot be the Arabs. Simple as that. I don't know how anybody could say that the Arab nations come from Esau. Please. Here's the family tree of Abraham. Abraham, through Hagar, had Ishmael, came the Arabs. Through Sarah, he has Isaac, and Isaac brings forth Esau and Jacob. They belong to the same family. So does Catholicism belong to our family. Came out of our ecclesia. They're two different lines. The sons of Ishmael and Esau in the future. Esau, end of Edomites, AD 70. No Edomites left, except, of course, spiritual Edomites. Sons of Ishmael, in Isaiah 60, verse 7, the rams of Nebajoth, one of the sons of Ishmael, will come up on mine altar. So will those of Kedar, another son of Ishmael. So that's why I want you in Isaiah 21. Come to Isaiah 21. Now, we were here briefly yesterday, remember? I had someone read out a couple of verses, remember that? For the lads that weren't here, we might just do it briefly again, shall we? Isaiah 21. Verse 1. The burden of the desert of the sea. Desert, wilderness. Sea, nations. It's a wilderness of peoples. Now, if you just cast your eye to the summary put in there by the translators under the words chapter 21. They say, the prophet, bewailing the captivity of his people, seeth in a vision the fall of Babylon. Edom is moved to repentance. The set time of Arabia's calamity. Well, it's a partly reasonable summary. It's certainly not terribly accurate in parts either. But you see, the point they're making is that when you come to verse 8 and 9, you find out what that phrase, the desert of the sea, is about. It's the wilderness of the peoples. It's Europe. Verse 8, and he cried, a lion, my Lord, in fact that should read Yahweh, I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime. I am set in my ward whole nights, and behold, here cometh a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. We know what this subject's about, fall of Babylon. And then in verse 11, the burden of Duma. This is one of those things they call an anagram, where there's a transposition of letters. It's actually a reference to Edom. But I want you to come to verse 13. The burden upon Arabia. In the forest in Arabia shall ye lodge, O ye travelling companies of Dedanim. So here is the burden or oracle on Arabia, and it's got to do with ye travelling companies of Dedanim. Who's Dedanim? Well, Dedanim's the descendants of Abraham and Cush. It's talking about those who came from the loins of Abraham, mingled themselves with the descendants of Cush somewhere along the line. And we know where they live. They live in this area down here, because it talks about Tamar. See there, it goes on to say this in verse 14. The inhabitants of the land of Tamar, which means the south, brought water to him that was thirsty. They prevented, or as the word could be rendered, they did meet with their bread him that fled. For they, these people fleeing, fled from the swords, from the drawn sword, and from the bent bow, and from the grievousness of war. So these travelling companies of Dedanim, they're nomadic people, they're Bedouin-like, they're Arabians, they can be traced back to Abraham, they live in the south of Israel, actually receive Jews that are fleeing from the events of Armageddon. And they meet those fugitives with their bread. So Gog's triumphant in the land, many Jews have to flee. The only real way to go is south. And down here, Christ and the saints have already been there to prepare the Arabs of that area to receive the Jews who flee. So what's their reward? Well, their reward is, did you notice those words in verse 13, second sentence? In the forest in Arabia shall ye lodge. Anyone know of a forest in Arabia? I've seen pictures of golf courses that they've got to keep watering. I haven't seen any forest in Arabia. But there will be in the future, when rivers flow in the desert, there will be a forest in Arabia. And that's going to be the reward of these peoples who succour the fleeing Jews in the day of Armageddon. They're going to become the next door neighbours of Israel, privileged people right next to Israel, blessed with a forest in what today is a desert. That's a different destiny to Edom, isn't it? So why would anybody want to say that Edom represents the Arabs? Arabia will be transformed in the forest, thickened with verdure, must ye lodge or dwell. Well, brethren, tomorrow morning, God willing, we're going to carry that on just a little bit and have a look at a star out of Jacob. And we'll actually get to Obadiah tomorrow morning, hopefully. But it's time for a video.